The Single Tracks podcast is brought to you by TPC, the Pros Closet. Spring is the perfect time to upgrade, and TPC has an industry-leading selection of new and certified pre-owned bikes, plus frames, wheels, and accessories. Each certified pre-owned bike is inspected, tested, and serviced, and every bike includes 30-day returns. Visit tpc.bike/singletracks and enter code singletracks40 to save $40 on every order over $200. That's the Pros Closet at tpc.bike/singletracks, and look for the link and coupon code in the show notes. Hey everybody, welcome to the Singletracks podcast. My name is Jeff, and today my guest is Nick Bennett. Nick is the executive director of the Vermont Mountain Bike Association, a position he's held for a little over 2 years. The group recently put together a 5-year strategic plan to ensure the sustainability of mountain biking in Vermont and thoughtfully promote exceptional riding experiences for all through advocacy, education, and community-driven stewardship. Thanks for joining us, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
That was a mouthful there too. Just so people know, that's like your mission statement, right?
For VMBA. You got to fit it all in one big package there. So yeah, it is a mouthful.
Yeah. So how did you end up as the executive director of the Vermont Mountain Bike Association?
That's a kind of circuitous path, but it's one like I think a lot of folks in the industry or sector here began in the basement of a bike shop. When I was a teenager, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. I hung out at the bike shop, was one of these BMX kids, and a couple of guys there saw that I loved working on bikes, riding bikes. Ron Cliff, Alex Bischoff, they run a shop called The Hub in St. Louis and still. And they took me in and helped me learn how to work on bikes, got me into mountain biking, got me out of the trails. This was the scene in St. Louis and Missouri has certainly evolved significantly since this was the late 90s, mid to late 90s. And so that's kind of what sparked my love for mountain bikes and riding generally. And so then from there, I ended up college on the East Coast. I got into sort of mountain bike racing in college, and that scene is amazing. If folks haven't, anyone that's been involved with collegiate racing knows how much fun, how much of a good time it is. Kind of the heart and soul of bike racing, and actually got really into road bike racing through that too. It was sort of a lot of the things that I think many of us enjoy about mountain biking in terms of adrenaline, camaraderie, those things exist in spades in road bike racing. And I, went deep down that path for almost a decade, kind of worked my way up to Cat One, was touring the country doing bike racing.
Wow.
Had a blast, but kind of strayed from the mountain bike path to some degree too, because I was spending a lot of time on skinny tires. And then during the course of that time, I college, went to grad school, and eventually I ended up in Seattle. I worked for a big consulting firm out in Seattle. I got my PhD and decided I didn't want to be a scientist anymore, but I enjoyed sort of a lot of the same tools that we use there. But when I moved out to Seattle, that's what rekindled my sort of passion and love for mountain biking. We got more, we started to ride out at Tiger, Raging River, Darrington, Tocal, all those places around the city. And really sort of got me back into the fold, and started to volunteer with Evergreen, started to get, see how amazing the community is up there. And, at the time, professionally, I had worked my way into sort of organizational consulting and actually was working eventually for a firm that only worked with mission-driven organizations and nonprofits. So basically helped advocacy organizations or small nonprofits and large foundations and things like that solve problems, come up with plans and work through on a whole host of topics, from environmental issues to social issues, what have you. And so that was my professional sort of bread and butter. And at the on the weekends and evenings, I was either on my bike or finding ways to volunteer. And it had always thought, like, how could I combine those two things professionally in a way that allowed me to pursue sort of the passion, but apply these tools.
Yeah.
And that was just sort of on the back burner. And then the pandemic hit in 2020. We were still living in Seattle at the time. I had at that point a 7-year-old son, and we're living essentially almost in downtown Seattle. And with the pandemic, the sort of walls started to close in terms of making it feel harder and harder to get to the mountains and get out on the trail. And we had known for a while, we kind of wanted to get a little further out, a little closer to nature. And so sold our house without much of a plan in the middle of the pandemic. We had a camper van though. And so the three of us got in the camper van and we lived out of that for 5 months and just drove around the West Coast, or really the Western U.S. It was sort of the best possible lemonade you could make out of those lemons. And went to, you know, we visited a dozen national parks, just lived near or at trailheads. We both took sabbaticals from our work. So we were part-time second grade teachers. And then the rest of the time we just rode our bikes and sort of followed the sun down south. And while we were doing that, a friend of mine who also volunteered with Evergreen and he had reached out, he said, hey, I don't know if you knew this, but Vermont Mountain Bike Association is looking for an executive director. And at the time, my wife's family has lived in Vermont for a long time. And we were already planning on coming here that spring so my son could get back into school. The school was in session up in Vermont. So we were already tracking, you know, back for at least for a book in our minds was going to be a short spell in Vermont. And I was like, well, this is a strange overlapping, strange coincidence here.
Yeah.
So the more I learned about the organization, talked with the board, talked to the people that were involved, the more I got really excited about this as an opportunity to take those professional skills that I'd put together with the passion that I have for trails and the outdoors. And I think really, my professional work had really been going down this thread of environmental impact and thinking about things like climate change and environmental stewardship. And I think one thing I've come to really understand is that the closer you can connect people with the outdoors, the more you can really sort of establish that love and appreciation for nature and appreciation for the importance of preserving what we have, not just for ourselves, but for our kids, grandkids, things like that. So this was like, I think I realized that I wanted to be on the front lines of that, of working to establish access in a sustainable way that really got people connected to the outdoors. So that's a very long story, just sort of summarized up to, you know, the board thought I was the right fit at the end of the day. And this is where I've been for the past little over two years.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, I think a lot of people probably have a similar story about, you know, making changes during the pandemic and, yeah, kind of figuring out like what's important and what they're really passionate about. And, you know, hearing your background kind of answers my next question. You know, we're going to talk about this 5-year strategic plan that the VMBA recently put out. And, you know, when I first looked over it, I was like, oh my gosh, like they hired some like, you know, expensive consultant to put this thing together. And yeah, I was going to ask, like, did your experience as a consultant help you craft this plan? Because I mean, that's what it looks like. It looks like something that, you know, a Fortune 500 company would put together to, you know, kind of look at their mission and their 5-year plan.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think fingerprints around that. I mean, I spent 5 years working for a very large management consulting firm that worked for Fortune 500 companies and helped them craft plans. So
yeah,
that experience, and I think more critically, where this is the time I spent at this small firm in Seattle called Camber Collective that, again, as I mentioned, works closely with nonprofit organizations, mission-driven organizations, foundations. And 100%, I mean, the tools or the skill set from those years really around stakeholder engagement and listening, because, you know, they're, and you'll notice in the plan, like we really try to hone in and identify partners. Who are we going to do this with and how are we going to work together? And I think that's born out of even FIMBA's model, which is a collection of 29 chapters that exist throughout the state. So I think that side of it, beyond even just like putting together a presentation or being able to, those sort of just hard skills of like, how do you try to package and communicate a plan. The biggest piece that I think was really valuable, and this plan specifically took over a year for us to put together. And we did it slow, deliberately. You mentioned you gave the mission statement the mouthful at the beginning, but we actually sat down with our board of directors back in January of 2022 and had a whole day just to look at the vision and mission statement. And I mean, it's kind of silly to think about. You spent 8 hours looking at two sentences, or, you know, a couple sentences. But that was that's the North Star for the organization. And we knew that we had to get that right. And then we would work and had spent a ton of time looking at our member survey and member feedback, chapter feedback, talking with our partners, and really were slow and deliberate in terms of each step along the way. I mean, I didn't touch or think about anything like this in my entire first year, really, with the organization, because my experience as a consultant, it's pretty humbling. Like, you come into these situations where there's a challenge or you're trying to kind of solve a problem, but you are not the expert.
Right.
The people that are there, they are the experts. And so I, you know, by going into so many different organizations, both really ones that were exceptionally well high functioning and others that were not, like, you learned that the first thing you do is you just listen and absorb, and you don't try to put your stamp on anything right away. So I feel really good about the fact about sort of that understanding those tools. And I think the benefit for us about being able to do it internally, and maybe that's part of the reason the board hired me, but it was like that ability to be close enough and to be able to work with folks and get them, versus I think there can be a challenge. I mean, I've been on the other side of that where you get brought in to develop a plan. It's hard because there has to be enough of the DNA in it that people really get. And so, I mean, the feedback we've heard from our chapters, from, again, the partners we work with, like, it's been so positive. And it's awesome to see, you know, specific examples. We have one of our specific goals, which we'll probably talk a little bit in a minute, and I think we'll talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion. But we highlighted kind of our goal that really hones in on that. And the Forest Service, who we work closely with, reached out and they were like, we want you to list us as a partner on that, because that's a critical thing as we think about recreational access in the Green Mountain Forest. So like having our partners say like, we want to be part of that thing too, it really kind of highlighted that we were headed the right direction.
Yeah. Well, was it different for you too? I mean, being a consultant, a lot of times you'll, like you said, you come in, you listen, you develop this plan, and then you're kind of out of there, right? Like you kind of parachute in and
luck.
Here you go, guys. Yeah. But is this a little different for you? Because like, you're the one who's staying on and you're the one who has to kind of shepherd this whole plan and process, you know, going forward.
So yeah, it is and it isn't. I think it's a good observation. I think any good consultant will know that you look at yourself as an advisor. So whether or not you are the one who actually has to implement that stuff, like, you know, the best firms or consultants, they work with people years over years. So you're going to keep coming back. And if you help someone develop something that doesn't work or get implemented or fails, like you're going to live with that because that's a relationship you have in a long term. So I think, you know, as long as you're, so it's not a, again, any like good advisor, it's not a transactional relationship. But that said, I mean, you're spot on. Like, and I was kind of excited for that challenge of not just being handed the sort of, okay, here's the answer, here's what we came up with, like, good luck.
Yeah.
But having to pilot that and having to work with folks to actually get it done. So I think that is a huge difference and a big challenge, and one that, you know, as great as I feel and the, you know, this plan may be, the hard work is in front of us. I mean, it was not easy to develop this, but, and we're already working towards, okay, how does this is the public facing document. That's really important because it's digestible, but how does this then translate kind of into the tools that we'll be using to track ourselves year over year and move forward? And I think the other part to your question that was really important for us, I mean, I've looked through a lot of plans in my prior life and things like that, where a plan resembles more of a wish list, which is not a plan. I mean, you know, if you're planning something for the day, the destination, that's not enough in terms of how you're going to get there. So
we did
spend a lot of time thinking through, and it's in the document, the long form document, of like, what are the milestones along the way? Like, what are the discrete, both achievable outcomes kind of in the next couple of years? And what are the things that we're going to do to get there? And even from a process standpoint, you know, I mentioned we did the missioning and the mission work and the vision work early on. But a lot of the work too was assessing what are our actual capabilities. Like, what is an organization? Does the VIMP office do? Do our chapters do? Do our partners do? Like, having that hard look, like, what are our skills, capacities, that type of thing. And so making sure that it was as realistic as it could be. So that's, I mean, that is in no way, shape, or form saying, okay, we figured it out, now we just have to like execute, because there's a ton of that that's going to change year over year. And I mean, you look at the pandemic, like the curveballs that come at us are immense. And so we can't be sort of locked in, but I think by having some goals as the guiding, as those, well, having the mission and vision as the guiding light, the goals is those, like, what are we actually tracking towards? And then enough in there that is designed to direct us how we're going to get there. You know, I feel good about it, but I also, I mean, I wouldn't say I'm terrified, but at times you're like, I look back, I'm like, we put a lot of stuff on the chalkboard in terms of things we want to do. But you know, what is interesting about it is, as we stepping back, like, and it goes, because I think sometimes things like mission and vision just get like, hey, somebody kind of comes up with a good phrase and that's good enough, and it kind of captures the B things. But for us to like, where we want to be with mountain biking at the center of healthy, resilient communities in Vermont, like in the next, in 5-10 years. And we're, you know, not that we're not there now, but like, it was kind of, if we're going to get there, we have to do these things. So it was sort of like working backwards in that way too, which made it feel like we weren't just like throwing pie in the sky. We were actually trying to pull back from that vision of where we want to end up.
Yeah. And so, I mean, we're talking a lot about this plan. We'll have a link to it in the show notes, but yeah, I mean, I was just struck too with sort of, you know, you have that high level part, but then you all went into a lot of detail about like sort of what you want to do and how you're going to get there, which I think is interesting. And Vermont actually was kind of an early adopter of this state advocacy model that kind of exists apart from EMBA. And we actually talked to your predecessor, Tom Stussy, a few years ago on the podcast. So I'm interested, like, how has this chapter model evolved since it was first launched, like the state advocacy sort of system that's in place in Vermont?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And Tom is a good friend of mine and was, I mean, incredibly gracious and helpful in getting me up to speed. He ran the ship here for 9 years and his fingerprints are still in the organization. So Tom's a hero and he's still, you know, I still reach out to him for advice. So, you know, in terms of how things have evolved, I think your first question about sort of, there's a piece around Vermont specifically, which if you come in, if you cross into Vermont, you don't have to see the Welcome to Vermont sign to know pretty quickly you're in Vermont, like the characteristic of the state. Yeah. You're like, man, rolling green hills, not seeing any billboards, like this lack of, or not just lack of development, but thoughtful development has its fingerprints on the state. So there's very much a character that, and that sort of links back to the land use laws and the development laws. There's a lot of constraints and also focus on how things are developed in Vermont. So I think in that sense, like, you can't be effective, certainly not now as a trail advocacy organization, without very intimate knowledge of how Vermont works and a close relationship with legislators, you know, the regulators, the policymakers, things like that, because it's a state that is so thoughtful and careful in how projects, development, what have you. And so that's a piece, I think, just like Vermont is a very, thoughtful in terms of how everything from trails to buildings are done. So I think that's an important sort of context. But then the chapter model, so kind of linking to that, but going backwards, I mean, it originally evolved as a pure advocacy organization. It was not, I mean, now we're the Vermont Mountain Bike Association, but back then, back in 97, we were the Vermont Mountain Bike Advocates. It was purely an advocacy organization pulled together of, at that point, I think folks were still referring to themselves as chapters, but it was more, let's get together when we need to advance, you know, to try to work on issues that are important at the state level. The first of which was this like limited landowner liability that ensures basically landowners can't be sued. And so we'll probably talk about that later in terms of like sort of private land stuff, but getting together on issues. And over time, sort of that collective model sort of pivoted from pure advocacy to one that was about actually more of a federation. And this is where Tom came in back in the early sort of 2010s of first saying, if we all work together and going beyond just like, let's get together when we need to, but let's create a common platform and a common backbone, essentially, not just of advocacy or education or these sort of state level work, but also on the operational side. And you know, because so many of our chapters had been around for, in some cases, decades, like that was a challenging transition. I think when things are born in the beginning and everyone says like, all right, we'll create this way and chapters evolve, I think if you look back 10 or 15 years, chapters were understandably skeptical. Like, wait a minute, what is this going to look like? Are you taking away my autonomy? Are you doing? And so it took several years, I think, for folks to really, for that model to start clicking. And one of the things that was so instrumental in it taking off was this idea of sort of shared membership or add-on membership, because we know, I mean, we have 29 chapters statewide. We have over 50 networks. I mean, this is in a state that's smaller than some national parks. It's kind of wild, but you have so many community-based networks and organizations and chapters that steward those networks that we encourage our members to be members of multiple chapters. And that ability by having a common platform to where, you know, I live in Waterbury, I'm a member of the Wadavimba chapter, but I can add on, whether it's Stowe, whether it's Woodstock, whether these other chapters, Slate Valley Trails, like I can add them to my membership. And that linkage, I think, was compelling for a lot of chapters. And over time, the real evolution since then, we haven't, and I think it's a really good thing, there hasn't been like a huge step, like we're fundamentally changing the way that works. But what we've been is slowly cementing this hub and spoke model where the Vimba office provides that state level advocacy, education, and the operational backbone, the everything from the membership platform I mentioned to things like payroll and insurance to a lot of the official guidance and supporting sort of documents and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the chapters are really driving community-driven stewardship. It's a word that's in our mission statement, but they are really, we are not directing how or where they should be building projects, providing the tools, but in terms of trail stewardship, projects, programs, like that's fully in the hands of our chapters. And I think it took a couple years and it continues to sort of solidify. But I think, you know, we're really moving to this model where it's one Vimba. It used to be, there used to talk about, there used to be a conversation. It still exists because it was around for so many years of like Vimba and the chapters, because Vimba used to be Vermont Mountain Bike Advocates and there were chapters. And now what we're really moving towards is we have the office. We have, you know, I work with a few other folks at the office. It's pretty small. And we have the chapters and we're all part of the Vermont Mountain Bike Association. And so that, you know, those, and I think, again, it kind of goes back to my like consulting days, conceptually, that takes a long time to adjust to and to feel comfortable with and to mm-hmm. feel like it's right. And we're still, you know, I was on a call last night with our advisory council. So we have a quarterly call with all the chapters where we, hey, you know, we share updates and but also try to solicit feedback and guidance and ensure that everyone feels like this thing, Vimba, is headed in the right way. And so I think, you know, that what you think the word uses evolution, it has really been very much that over time. There was what Tom drove 10 years ago, which was really creating the model. And then mm-hmm. over time, it's really grown into what I think is a really awesome, I feel like it's really clicking in terms of everyone embracing that role of office, working with the chapters, and together we're the Vermont Mountain Bike Association.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. So one of the parts of the five-year strategic plan that I notice is a section about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And this is something that, you know, a lot of organizations are talking about, but I'm curious, like, how does this fit in with trail advocacy? So obviously most of us would agree, like, it's the right thing to do, but like, How does it help the mountain bike community?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think first and foremost, and you hit on it, it's the right thing to do. Like, mm-hmm. and we shouldn't look past that. But I think it is worth asking kind of beyond that. And periodically, particularly when we started to embark on a lot of the DEI work we're doing, the questions came up like, why are you talking about this? Like, you're a trail advocacy organization. Stay in your lane sort of feedback.
Yeah.
But I mean, first thing, and I observe this, witnesses firsthand and working with organizations, like, diverse organizations and communities are stronger. Mm-hmm. The more perspectives and variety of people you have engaged, like, the more resilient your organization is, and more effective it'll be. So, and we think of our organization, like, beyond just the chapter, the people, the staff, the volunteers, mm-hmm. it's the members too. So I think that that idea of, like, we have a stronger membership, the more people are participating involved. But I do think there is even, I wouldn't call it self-interested, but the idea of access, the more that mountain biking can be perceived and fulfilled, that's mission is sort of like a conduit for historically underrepresented groups to get out in the woods, mm-hmm. the more support we're going to receive from the broader community, from legislators. Like, we can do so much in terms of, and I think about this a lot, we work closely with Vermont Adaptive. Here in Vermont, we've, mm-hmm. we've in the past couple of years been trying to really sort of enhance the adaptive friendliness of our networks and doing hands-on assessments and directing funding to make those improvements. And it's kind of struck me, like, particularly being out of the woods with folks that are adaptive riders, I'm like, man, mountain bike trails can bring these people into the woods in a way that a hiking trail can't, or that a lot of other, like, you know, our construction models and many trails, not all mountain bike trails, but many trails are super well suited to getting more folks out in the woods, whether they be adaptive riders or people new to the sport or new to the outdoors, you know, whether they be from, again, it could be from BIPOC communities, it could be from the adaptive community. I think the ability for us to be welcoming and bring those people out into the, and connect them with nature and connect them with outdoor recreation, like, that is a calling card, makes people really, we're seeing it more and more in Vermont. We're seeing access as a really hot topic. And I think what's going to make it, and we'll talk about this in a bit, but as mountain biking has evolved from sort of the fringe sport to one that's much more mainstream, I mean, we've got the equivalent of 1.5% of the Vermont population are card carrying Vimba members. Mm. As it becomes more of like that, actually, this is a more mainstream sport. Mm-hmm. The scrutiny and the sort of level of rigor, however you want to think about it, like, we have to step up our game. And I think one of the things being able to do and say our sport is working to enhance access, that will open doors for us that are enhance accessibility, and access and accessibility are obviously related. But so I think that's kind of the self-interested piece. And I think the thing that we, and in our strategic plan, like, one of the things we did early on was we tried to think carefully, like, who are our constituents and what is our goal and who are we serving in some sense? Because we wanted to get away from the model. Like, our goal is not just to, like, let's get as many people to Vermont to mountain bike as we can. Like, that doesn't make our lives easier. That makes it harder to maintain trails. Like, that is not our mission. Our mission is to our members. But when we thought about membership, we going back to that thing, like, our most resilient and strong community is a diverse one. We thought about, like, our future membership. Mm. So we thought about a membership that was more inclusive. Like, who are the people that aren't, that would be a part of our, if we were more welcoming and inclusive, that would be a part of our community. So that's our constituency. And with that in mind, it's like, that's who we're serving. So that, I think, embracing that idea and like that, and that our goal is really around selectively really welcoming, not just saying like, hey, we're inclusive, like, come and ride if you want, but being more targeted. Yeah. Like, how do we make people, to bring people into Vermont that, or, and bring people, you know, into the onto the trails. And I think one of the things we've seen, you know, we field a membership survey every year, close to 10% of our membership responds to it. So it's a pretty like decent, meaningful sample. Mm-hmm. And when we ran it this year, a majority of our, of the respondents felt that diversity, equity, inclusion should be at or among our top priorities.
Wow.
So that, you know, we asked that question and that's a majority of our, of those respondents. And then less than 10% disagreed with that. So in my mind, like, it felt good in the sense that, I mean, A, we've decided to go that direction, and B, the membership, or at least those that responded, the 800 or so folks, like, basically agreed with that statement. So I think that that felt good in that I feel like we've conveyed that message, and the membership is supportive.
Yeah. I think too, like, it's interesting the way you describe it, because I think for a lot of people, they see that, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and they think, I don't know, we automatically jump to like racial diversity, which Vermont is not like a super racially diverse state.
Nope.
But really, we're talking about all groups that are not currently riding, right? So I think of kids, like if we get more kids riding, then who's going to say no to kids? If people are like, hey, we need trails for our kids, you know, like everybody's going to be on board with that. And so, yeah, that's, I feel like that's a perfect example of kind of broadening your group to, yeah, make it more. Yeah. What's the word I'm looking for?
Bigger tent. I mean, and I think that's, and we've seen the youth. I mean, there's a chapter that I really love, the Riding Down Woodstock, Vermont. And a couple of years ago, that chapter was really challenged in terms of their ability to develop new trail, and the town was, I wouldn't say hostile, but just skeptical. And it was, they were challenging to work with. And they, at the same time, had some really passionate people at the school system there. Their chapter folks had kids, and they got them just stoked on riding, and they got a racing team going through their school. And then just a couple of years later, I mean, I was down there for trail work days, and there are parents out there on a Saturday morning doing trail work that do not ride mountain bikes.
Oh, wow.
I was talking to them and they're like, no, my kids ride. And so I'm out here, you know, with a shovel and just, you know, helping improve this trail system. And last year they opened up almost what would have been unthinkable a couple of years ago, this sort of amazing trail that runs directly from, almost directly from the town center to the top of Mount Peg, or kind of to one of the summit points of Mount Peg. Mm-hmm. That's a green, accessible, like amazing trail that the mountain bike chapter built with the town support. And it was like the turnaround in a couple of years by really activating, getting kids engaged was just transformative. So you're spot on. Mm. Like that's a, if you want the easiest switch to like get folks supportive, it's definitely through youth.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. So I was reading the plan and there's a section about e-bike access. And one of the things that I pulled out that I really love is this focus on etiquette, not equipment. So is e-bike access a hot topic in Vermont, and how are you kind of looking at that, in terms of etiquette versus equipment?
Yeah. I mean, I'd say it's a warm topic. I wouldn't necessarily say it's, you know, there are other areas in the country where it's, I think, a little spicier, but, and that's for a couple of reasons. I mean, in Vermont, we don't have the same degree of sort of monolithic public land managers like there are elsewhere in the West and mm-hmm. things like that. And the reality is that we don't have any BLM land in Vermont. So it's the Forest Service whose policy is pretty clear and mm-hmm. you know, not very open to e-bikes, and at the state level too, it's pretty limited at the moment too. So
right.
That said, with 70% of our public access trails on private land, it really comes down to the private landowners. And with that in mind, our focus is really on education, which I think the reality is there's a lot we know about e-bikes and there's a lot that we don't know. And so we've been supporting studies and to essentially like really, I think more than anything, investigate sort of who is riding these bikes and what are the mm-hmm. social impacts in terms of sort of impacts on safety or sort of the experience in networks. Because the sense that we have from what's out there on the actual trail impact is that e-bikes are 99% mountain bikes. Like, you know, it's practically class one pedal assist. And we're really trying to even move the language away from e-bikes, because I think to some people that can inspire throttle closer things to dirt bikes, which are a whole different category. And we're talking about pedal assist class one mountain bikes. And so the reality out here too is that the vast majority of users, I think there's been a little bit of a misframing of, I think, at least the community, because here the majority of e-bike users, they're folks who really wouldn't be out on the trail if they didn't have that pedal assist. They're either getting older or have injuries. Like those are the people we see using e-bikes. And if those are bringing people out on the trail who wouldn't be able to ride otherwise, like it's hard to look at that as a negative, like that, you know? Yeah. And so what I think we're trying to do is make sure the information is clear. We're pursuing more information on some of these pieces because, you know, it's the reality is even if the impact of a EMTB for the same sort of rolling down the trail is the same as a mountain bike, like, yeah, you can ride further and you can ride longer on an e-mountain bike without pedal assist so that there can be more impacts. And thinking about, like, does, I think the question for us that we're honing in on is, are there impacts to other users' experiences, like collectively? And, you know, the data is still coming in on that. And most of what we see is off, usually not. It depends a lot on the network and the design. And that's going back to like the landowners and the chapters. If the networks are built in a way where, yeah, this isn't impacting other folks' sort of user, their experience. And if the landowners are supportive, okay, you know, that's great. And if they're, and for us, really at the end of the day, it comes back to the landowner. And an interesting sort of conversation, this is like in a microcosm we've had, is our chapters will go or be checking in with the landowner. The landowner will say, hey, I just want to let you guys know I don't want e-bikes on my trail, on the trails on my land. And the chapter will say, that's cool. Let's just make sure we're all on the same page. Like, and they'll walk through, okay, these are what e-bikes are. Like, this is a class one pedal assist. And this is what a, you know, what a Saron or these other sort of throttle bikes might be. And they're more... oftentimes, I won't say more often than not, like the landowner will say, oh, like those are fine. That's, you know, the pedalist, and who are the people using this? And okay, generally this, they're like, oh yeah, that's fine. I just don't want dirt bikes on my trail. So I think it goes back to like, what is our goal now? And you mentioned it, like etiquette, not equipment. You can do so much more damage on an analog bike than you can on an e-bike if you ride it the wrong way or at the wrong time, or you go out on a muddy trail and rip it up. So I had this idea of like, basically trying to be purely around equipment is one that we don't think fosters the right attitudes and understanding. So we go back to education, like from a trail impact standpoint, that idea of like, if you're leaving a rut, whether it's, you know, now we're wrapping up fat bike season, if it's in the snow or certainly on the dirt, like turn around, be respectful of the trail. Think about user interactions. Like if you're, you know, that's a big one too. Like, and I'm a part of the Trails Are Common Ground sort of working group that's been advancing that mission, that organization, and the, you know, the same, the principle around just like, be thoughtful about everyone's out here to have a positive experience. And I think working back to etiquette, working back to just compassion is way more effective than trying to hone in on equipment.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense to me. And like you're saying, you know, it does depend on the trail and it depends on the landowner, but really, at the end of the day, it depends on the rider, I feel like. And that's kind of what this cuts to the heart of, is that people can be jerks on any kind of bike. They could be a jerk. Hikers can be jerks, but it comes back down to etiquette, and it doesn't really matter what your equipment is. It's kind of down to the rider and what their attitude is, and making sure that they understand how to ride and how to be respectful.
Totally. And I think one of the things, just building on that too, is like, because the mountain bike community is still emerging from almost like an adolescence in terms of, you know, where we were, there was more rogue trail building and it was, you know, sort of solidifying ourselves as a sport. We don't have the prevailing assumption that we are good, friendly all the time. I would say like the prevailing assumption about that sort of behavior of mountain bikers isn't necessarily positive amongst everybody. So it doesn't, you know, one bad actor can, and it's happened here in Vermont. We'll probably talk about it in terms of the difference with private land and public land, but one or a couple bad actors like out there being jerks can compromise land access, particularly on private land. So we have a lot more work to do as a community. Once we can get to a point where the default assumption is like, hey, that mountain bike community is improving accessibility, they're creating sustainable trails, like they're great. That guy's a jerk. Hey, that's fine. We're not going to shut down a trail, but we have, you know, the more we can sort of create that collective perception of mountain bikers, the more we can be resilient to the folks that are not going to listen. And they're always going to be folks that are not going to be nice people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, how close do you think we are to that point? I mean, mountain biking has been around for a long time now. And yeah, and somehow we still have this perception that we're not always good actors and that, yeah, we're going to be building rogue trails. Like, how does that change? And like, how close are we to getting to the right side of that?
I think it depends pretty dramatically on your location and where you are. I mean, I can speak for here in Vermont, because the community, you know, because we have such a high percentage of folks involved and that benefit from trails, I think we're closer probably than in a lot of areas. Like the state collectively sees the work that our chapters are doing. This idea of community driven stewardship isn't it is trail building, but it's not purely trail building. It's about understanding what the community needs, wants, thinking about infrastructure beyond just trails. Where are people going to park? Where are people going to poop? Like those are really important questions that aren't often asked. So like being thoughtful. beyond just the trail. And so we're doing some work with to sort of collect better data in terms of understanding. It's easy to know what people believe in your membership or what people think the people you work most closely with, but it almost links back to that, like the DEI question too. Like, how do you reach people who you don't talk to all the time is really challenging. So We see it in communities. I mean, there is, I think the biggest challenge, honestly, it's less about, even at this point here, the mountain bike community, more about kind of outdoor recreation generally, that it's It's a booming thing. It's become an industry there. It's so critical to so many community economies across the country. But there's also pushback in terms of how much is too much, how many, you know, do we need another trail here? So we're seeing those questions are definitely coming up more than anything. So I think the short answer is, I have to think we're close. You know, I think that I know the way that legislators engage with us, and I'm part of an organization in Vermont called the Vermont Trails and Greenways Council, which is a collection of, it's super cool. It's kind of a collection of all the trail advocacy organizations. So not just VIMBA, but snowmobilers, VAST, the ATVers, VASA, the Green Mountain Club. You know, we had the Kingdom Trails as part of, like, all the trail stewardship organizations, or most, are members of this collective. And the way legislators sort of want to work with us and listen to us, like, I get the sense that we're really close on that front. And we have, but that doesn't mean we can let our guard down. I think that, again, if I look at our sort of our hope or the 5-year strategic plan, I would say that at the end of that, we're at a spot where that's generally the perception.
Yeah. So it sounds like a lot of those groups are able to work pretty well together. I mean, do you think, is it a challenge just by virtue of the fact that you call yourselves a mountain bike association? Like, a lot of groups around the country, they're kind of shifting that focus and calling them, you know, the Sustainable Trails Coalition. Like, you know, we're just for trails, or Sierra Buttes Trail Fellowship. Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of these groups, they're kind of rebranding and saying, hey, we're for all trail users. Is that ever like a barrier for you guys, like calling yourselves mountain bikers, because there is that perception?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's like, I feel like there could be a whole podcast on that topic, but many of our chapters don't, or they are the, you know, Stowe Trails Partnership, for example, or the Caledonian Trail Collaborative. Like, they're at least in their names, they're not mountain bike purely. And many of our chapters are building certainly multi-purpose trails. And in some cases, like, trail designs are like, we're going to create a hiking trail here because it allows us to have more, you know, better user flow in terms of one way downhill and providing a spot for hikers and stuff.
Yeah.
I think it goes back. I mean, we actually wrestle with this a lot, even in the strategic plan. And I think at the end of the day, like, we didn't want to lose that connection to mountain biking. Like, at our core, we wanted really to, you know, and it goes back to the membership, like, who's, and it's an experience that is rooted in, like, making it an amazing place to ride a mountain bike. And I think that doesn't preclude us from doing really important work in terms of building up, in engaging other users. And we are really thinking about, we have a lot of members already who aren't mountain bikers, as I mentioned, like, whether it's parents that have kids that ride, or even just community members that are like, I see the value these trails bring, but because they're members of their local chapter, like, that communication, if it's Stowe Trails Partnership, or as I mentioned, Caledonia Trail Collaborative, or whoever, like, that they get it, they get what they're doing, what's happening in their community, and they see it. I almost would rather, like, I'd rather have it demonstrated by our actions. I don't think we're limited. I think people are seeing that, you know, Vermont Mountain Bike Association, or VIMBA, or if you don't want to, like, have the word mountain bike at top of mind, like, are improving access for everybody. So it's this, like, I wouldn't call it a tension, but it's at least a spectrum, right? Of, like, we never want to lose that core of, like, making incredibly fun and creating, you know, an experience for mountain bikers, but at the same day realizing that, like, that also means inviting and involving all trail users. So it's not an easy answer, I guess I'd put it that way.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that actually, what, 1% or 1.5% of the folks in Vermont are a part of VIMBA, which I think I read you guys have 10,000 dues paying members, something like that.
Spitting distance. So our plan is, we were 9,500 last year. So we often say almost 10,000 and goal. Yeah, we'll round up.
So how did you get so many people to sign up? I mean, you know, I've talked to a lot of mountain bike groups around the country, and a lot of them, they're in areas with way more population, and they struggle to get like 1,000 people to sign up. So how did VIMBA get 10,000 people to commit? Even though, I mean, it's not a lot of money, but it's tough for people to get that. So how did you get those commitments from folks?
Yeah. So good question. And I think to distill it down, I mean, I think it's on sort of pulling on different heartstrings. So the first, and this is the kind of folks that are members typically of advocacy organizations throughout the company, are ones that who really understand that membership equals voice and voice equals access. Like, it's as simple as that in terms of if they're not supporting their local or state or whatever mountain bike organization, that threatens their ability, their long-term accessibility, and the importance of supporting the work that's being done and both on the ground in terms of stewardship at the state house, what have you. So like those people that get it in terms of how this all works, and that, you know, if you pay hundreds of dollars for a ski pass, paying $60 for a membership to support your local mountain community is a heck of a steal. So there's that group.
Yeah.
And those are people, it's more about communication. But the other ways we think about it, we have this really compelling member benefits program. So Vermont, it's a small state. We have over 100 businesses throughout the state that participate in the VIMBA member benefits program, which means if you're a member, you can show up to that organization and you there's a deal or discount or what have you. You get, you know, we have at least over 30 independently owned bike shops that are in the program that give you parts discounts or rental discounts or what have you, or deals that, and it goes beyond bike shops. It's retailers, it's lodging, it's restaurants. So pretty compelling set. I think we did the math last year. Like, if you took advantage of every member benefit, it was like over $4,000 in value or something like that. So it's a pretty like impressive set. Yeah. And one of the cool things this year, even to go deeper on that one, is we're going to be launching in a couple of weeks here, a VIMBA app. And so we know that, you know, we've typically been a very paper driven sort of membership model. And we've given people a membership, plastic membership card and a list of their benefits. And like, you could be in a town, you're like, I wonder if, you know, I forgot my sheet. I forgot my piece of paper. Like, how am I going to know what's here? So by placing that all on mobile devices, folks will be able to go. And I should mention, like, including in amongst those member benefits, we have 5 single day lift passes to lift access riding throughout the state.
Wow.
So yeah, that's, I mean, you buy a $60 membership, you get $250 at least worth of lift passes. Like, so that idea of like, if you're not bought into the advocacy piece or don't get that yet, at least like do this because it's in your own economic interest to like to pick up a membership. And so super compelling piece there. And then the third stool is a little bit on the like peer pressure side of things, which for a long time we've had these, you know, VIMBA strips that every year we change color, and they allow folks to sort of publicly show like, I'm a VIMBA member, I support the trails. And I think that's important because people can show like, if you don't have your VIMBA strip, you're out on the trail and you're like, you're either people like, I forgot it today, it's on my other bike or whatever. And I think that level of like public acknowledgement or is there's some value there. So people like don't want to be seen without that strip that shows that they're part of the community. So I think that idea of like, you have to use differencing, like back in my consulting days, we called it influencing techniques, but like, what's going to be compelling for someone to be a member? If it's not the, you hope it's the advocacy and we continue to play, to beat that drum and hope that folks eventually buy into that piece. But then if it means, oh yeah, this membership pays for itself when I use one of these lift tickets, cool, it's great.
Yeah.
And then if it, beyond that, it's the public, you know, sort of peer pressure side of things that they need to be feeling like they're missing out if they're not a member.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And I have a feeling a lot of folks listening to this are going to think, well, maybe we should try that too. Are the strips that you're talking about, is this like a sticker or something you put on your bike?
It's a Velcro strip. It's just, it's a perfect size to go around your seat post, go around your stem, whatever. It's usually a bright Velcro strip that, that changes year to year. So it's not a sticker. It's easy to move around. You can, if you've got a couple bikes, you can easily move it from one to the next. And that was a Tom. I mean, that was something, and I think this was many years ago, like, we need to find some way where the folks can more easily show that they're a VIMBA member. And that was the solution.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, obviously Vermont is, it's a mountain bike destination for a lot of folks who live in the Northeast and even people from around the country. And I understand that there has been a push, maybe it was in the past, maybe it's something current, to get even out of state folks supporting VIMBA. Is it a challenge when you have such a big group of sort of out of town riders using the trails, but yet you rely on the locals to kind of support them?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it kind of ties back to our membership, where I think in the neighborhood of 20% of our members are out of state. So we've had a pretty good, and those could be folks that have either second homes here or you know, at least their mailing address is out of state of Vermont. But I think it's, I would say it's certainly a challenge because you communicate with those folks in different ways. They're not living here. It's a different way to resonate. But because we work, and I think we've identified part of our strategic plan, one of the goals is to have a majority of the ridership in Vermont be VIMBA members. Like that's an objective where, so then we can say like majority of people riding trails, like are part of our community. And a lot of those are, as you mentioned, out of state. And so the ways we can do that, I think it's kind of the partnerships we work with too. We know we've sort of try to identify what are the points of access that people are coming into the state, like for example, the downhill resorts. And they've been the partners we work with. We have Killington, Stratton, Burke Mountain, Sugarbush, and Bolton Valley. They are amazing in terms of helping us communicate our message around membership. Like they get it. They're 100% bought in. And so those places, we work closely with the Vermont Department of Tourism and Marketing. We collaborate on a bunch of events and they're also, they are almost always receptive to like sort of that membership message too, even going out to like people that are here to ride for the first time. So, you know, I think because we have a pretty compelling, as I mentioned, like you do question around like, why would people be members? Like it doesn't take a whole lot. You don't have to twist someone's arm too much. It's not that much money. You get, you know, between the member benefits as well as the importance of supporting the trails, like the sell isn't very hard. And so it's a question of that, like just getting folks exposed. So identifying those points of access, which for us, a lot of it's the downhill resorts. It's also other sort of working with tourism and then just getting that message out there. And I think the other thing I would say too is there's a bit of a critical mass element too, which, you know, it goes back to even membership in Vermont. Like once you have enough people that have these strips on their bike or talk about VIMBA or their local chapters, like then it's a lot easier to get the next, you know, there's diminishing returns too. So it's certainly some kind of a curve shape. I'm not sure what how to describe it, but like that idea that it's about awareness. And because we work with partners to build that awareness, I'm, you know, it's where the growth in our membership will be 100% will be from. And it goes back to like, what is our goal when we think about that? It's not to drive more people to come ride in Vermont. It's the people that are coming to ride in Vermont, ensure that they know what VIMBA is, does, and ideally become members.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you mentioned the Vermont Tourism Office, and I mean, obviously their job is to bring people to Vermont. Do they support VIMBA at all, like financially? Because I know a lot of these tourism groups, they raise money through hotel funds and things like that. But then a lot of that money doesn't always go back to trails, which is the reason people came to the state in the first place. So how does the tourism office kind of support you guys?
Yeah, it's a great question. They have in the past provided direct operational support. There are some constraints that haven't allowed them to do that at the moment. So, you know, the legislature had some concerns about why is tourism sort of directly funding operational support for organizations. So I think there's some good questions in there, but you know, the connection is a really important one. So for example, we have a tourism day at the State House actually tomorrow here, March 22nd. And I'll be speaking there there's a joint session of the House and the Senate, and I'll be speaking on behalf of outdoor recreation and trails there. And that's the representation, and the Department of Tourism sort of talks about destination stewardship. So their support, given their constraints, is basically helping us make that message to the remainder, to the legislature generally, and saying there needs to be funding streams that go to support stewardship and support the organizations, not just VIMBA, but Green Mountain Club, you know, Kingdom Trails, other organizations supporting all kinds of outdoor recreation so that this can continue to happen. So they are 100% bought into the concept that stewardship is critical, and they're helping us really work. And that's, you know, some of what's gone in strategic plan too, is what are the avenues for long-term sustainable funding? Because, you know, it's kind of, and it goes back to like, why did we even do this strategic plan? And it's also coupled to the growth in outdoor recreation. Like we're in a spot now where we will always be a volunteer at our heart, like a volunteer sort of driven organization, that you can't replace 30,000 volunteer hours with paid staff, and it's not possible. And the idea that community members are so engaged in the process is critical. That said, we have to profess, like as you begin to maintain 1,000 miles of trail and so many more user types and adhere to pretty stringent best manager practices, like you need to professionalize. That's part of the game. And so that takes money. And so we're working with the legislature. We have the support of tourism. They buy into it, but it's sort of like what the ultimate model for that looks like. I mean, we'll see, but I think there is a bit of a tension there too. And you nailed it, which is like every additional person that comes and rides in the state that's another pair of wheels or boots or whatever on the trail, and it has impact. So ultimately there has to be some way that feeds back to support stewardship.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely a tricky one, and one that I know a lot of places are struggling with. And like you said, a lot of times it is, you know, there's a law at the state level that kind of dictates how those funds can be spent. But yeah, hopefully, yeah, we'll definitely be watching to see how Vemba navigates that and sort of see how maybe that could work in other states as well. One of the things you mentioned that's kind of unique about Vermont is that a lot of the trails, there isn't a lot of public land. A lot of trails are located on private land. And I imagine there are challenges associated with that. Is that, in your opinion, is that like a blessing or is it a curse? Like, is it, would you wish that on other folks to, like, you know, be dealing with private landowners? Or do you think maybe it's easier in some ways to work with public land managers?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I don't think I think there are absolutely pros and cons. And I would say too that Vermont's interesting because we don't have a lot of trails on public land. I mean, we have things like the Long Trail and Appalachian Trail, which are, you know, legacy projects that run mainly through things like the Green Mountain National Forest and a lot of state land. But we actually have a fair amount of public land between the 400,000 acres of the Green Mountain National Forest and a similar amount of state land. So we are working closely with the Forest Service and with the state of Vermont to expand recreational access on those public lands, because it's the minority of access now. And for partners, I mean, example, you know, we've got plans with the Forest Service. They're building, I mean, we've just, there's a IRP, an integrated resource project, that's going through a telephone gap that's going to add, I think, 30 plus miles of mountain bike trails to the network there. So there's definitely a push to grow public land here. And that's important because then it links to sort of what are the pros and the cons. Public land is permanent public access, which is critical, right? There's, barring some catastrophe, those trails are going to remain open to the public. The trails on private land are much more tenuous, and there's high profile stories of, you get a couple, we talked about it a little while ago, like a couple users behaving badly, a landowner can withdraw their land from public access. And sometimes, in some cases, that can sever network and critical connections. And we do a lot on that front to try to work against, to try to prevent that. We have written landowner access agreements that are for 10 or, you know, usually 10 years of access. And that allows us to both access public dollars for those trail projects, but also gives us peace of mind that the next year the landowner is not going to say, oh, cool, you built a $40,000 section trail here, you know, it's mine now, or it's no longer open for the public. So there's that concern. And I can talk in a minute about sort of what we're doing to try to address that piece. But then on the positive side, I mean, the reality is that it is much easier oftentimes to work with a private landowner. It's one individual or a family or what have you. And they say, I love, trails are amazing, like, let's talk about a vision. And then the next week you could be building a trail because, you know, the private landowner has land. And Vermont has this amazing ethos, and has for a long time, about public access recreation on private land, because so much of the state was accounted for before, and, you know, major tracts of public land could be established. The default assumption, and it's in statute too, is you can recreate on private land unless it's posted. So this idea of, you know, the Vermonters allow folks to hunt, and I mean, you could be in your backyard, people could be hunting season, people will be back there unless you post signs. I mean, there's stipulations about proximity to houses and stuff like that. So there are some rules on that front, but generally lands are open. And so that's great. And it's the sort of default assumption. And so when we have private landowners that are interested in seeing trails, they get the value that public access provides. Those projects can happen at low cost, efficiently, be effective. We still follow, obviously, all building best manager practices and work with communities to make sure it fits into the bigger plan. But on that sense, like, it can be very straightforward. But that question of permanent access is a challenge, because land can change hands and a lot of other things can happen. So one of the really interesting things in Vermont, and this is getting a little bit in the advocacy weeds, but it can be quick, is like there's a program called the Use Value Appraisal Program. It's often referred to as current use, which landowners that essentially is designed to incentivize landowners not to develop their land. So if you either actively manage, so you sort of log your land or actively manage it for timber, if you have agriculture, you have a farm on it, or if you conserve it in certain ways, you actually lower your tax burden, because the state's saying, all right, you've chosen not to develop this in a way you can make more money. We're going to reduce the burden of the tax, your tax burden for that parcel of land.
Yeah.
Recreation is not a part of that currently. There are other states where it is in similar programs. So we're working long-term is like, if a landowner is going to guarantee public access recreation through trails on their property, they should similarly, that's a public benefit that is an alternative to development. They should absolutely be part of that program too. So that's an example of, like, if we can be successful on that front in the next couple of years, then a landowner has an incentive. Then it's not, you know, they might have a negative experience with the user, but it's not, all right, I'm out. They'd have to think like, well, if I'm going to withdraw my, if I'm going to withdraw public access, my tax bill is going to go back up to normal next year. So there's at least thinking through like, what are the things we can do to, we call it just like kind of refer to it as stickiness, but make sure that landowners are sticky. But the last thing I'll say is, because that's not, I mean, it does force us, it's a forcing mechanism for us to have really good relationships with landowners and forces our chapters to go all the time and have those conversations, have a cup of coffee, just make sure people are, under, you know, if there's any issues and stuff like that. So we don't ever want to lose sight of that. And we always want to think landowners are essential to, as I mentioned, it's 70% of public access in Vermont. If they withdrew their support, it would turn out like a light in terms of what people can do outside here in the state.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. And yeah, sounds like it definitely keeps you on your toes in terms of, always making sure you're doing the right things and that riders are educated and all of that. Definitely sounds tricky. So one last thing, you mentioned in an email that the best places to ride aren't west of the Mississippi. So I'm curious, what, in your opinion, what's so great about mountain biking on the East Coast of the U.S.?
I think I might have said aren't all west of the Mississippi, because I don't want to get into an East Coast, West Coast throwdown. And I spent, I mean, as I mentioned, like I lived in the Pacific Northwest for 10 years and I, you know, around the pandemic, we traveled throughout the, you know, sort of through a bunch of this mountain biking meccas from sort of the Idaho area to Moab to St. George. Like I've ridden a ton out there and I love riding in the desert. I love riding in the Pacific Northwest. Like it's, they're amazing places to ride out there. I think they're also amazing places to ride all throughout the Northeast, through Pisgah, if you go to the Southeast, through, you know, there's so much incredible, not just terrain, but I think part of what makes a place like Vermont special, or, you know, there's riding up in Quebec that's fantastic. Like, one of the really cool things here, as I mentioned, you know, as a state, Vermont, smaller than some national parks, 50 plus trail networks, many of which are woven into communities. So one of the things that I didn't love about living out west was getting in a car, sometimes spending an hour and a half for what should have been a 30-minute drive to get to the trailhead, or that idea of like, it was harder oftentimes to weave outdoor recreation into everyday life. You kind of had to like compartmentalize it, or it was the weekend thing, or, and in a place like Vermont, what's cool and it's neat if you can come in when, if people, when they do visit here, is like you, it's so connected into these communities. We have so many outdoor communities where the trails are sort of the backyard or out the back door. And that plus the combination of there's some really amazing places to ride, Vermont, New Hampshire, geologically, like there's some really cool just rock formations, like things you wouldn't see elsewhere. There's a history of sort of like, because a lot of the original trails that came out here were that sort of old school tech jank, you know, that was the sort of, which has plagued as sort of this big intermediate trail that's like not super interesting, but you know, is kind of awkward. But with the step up in the game, just in terms of trail building and with so much, I think as we've developed better, not just better manager practices, but better design approach and practices, like the terrain we have to work with is pretty awesome. And so that combination of like, if you want to come to a place that has community woven into mountain bike trails and like you have this ability to sample so many different pieces. And I think one thing we are working on that, and a thing I miss about the West, and I think we have an opportunity to actually develop here in Vermont through projects like the Velomont, which is intended to be this 485-mile trail corridor that runs from Massachusetts to Canada that's going to connect over 20 VIMPA networks, is that idea of like the sort of true backcountry experience, like that ability to go on a four-hour pedal and feel, really get into that, like the flow state, you know, thing that's described sort of from a psychological standpoint, like that flow state and be out there in the woods and lost, like, we're trying to be really thoughtful about how we link together these networks and hubs of chapworks so that folks can have that like deep woods experience. And as we do that, I mean, that to me is really the piece that, the only piece that's harder to find. It's not impossible to find out here, but it's harder to find. And so I guess at the end of the day, like diversity is the spice of life. And so there's, we traveled to Sedona last fall to get some riding in the rocks in the desert, and it's amazing. And I love it out there. And, you know, it's, but it's also nice to come home and ride some dirt and ride, you know, ride like these different things. So I think there's no one, like that is the place to go because it has the best mountain biking, even though there was a study and that came out that sort of identified Vermont as the best place based on some metrics, like, you know, the nature of the terrain and a bunch of other things. So you can come up with, you can sort of, you know, skew that title however you want, but that idea of there is really quality and there's amazing riding. Like we did a trip down to Pisgah last spring and all along the way, like you can find amazing places to ride and York, Pennsylvania, like Maryland, like there are these really great spots throughout. And so not sort of pigeonholing as like, this is the best place to go, but acknowledging that there are a million amazing places to ride all over the country.
Yeah. And for different reasons, like you mentioned, you know, places. I mean, I was thinking too, while you were talking, that the fact that you do have so many trails on private land, that's what enables that connectivity, you know, like in the towns and things that you don't find out west necessarily, where a lot of the trails are on public land. And so, you know, unless you're in a spot where like town goes right up to the public land, like otherwise you're going to be driving places. And yeah, it sounds like in Vermont, you have that sort of patchwork of, you know, access and, you know, public and private spaces. And yeah, definitely a really different experience.
Totally.
Well, Nick, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us. It sounds like Vemba is doing some really interesting things and a lot of things that folks in other parts of the country can learn from and implement in their areas as well. So thanks.
Thanks a ton, Jeff. Really appreciate it.
Well, you can get more information about Vemba at vmba.org. And we'll also have a link to that strategic plan in the show notes. That's all we've got this week. Talk to you again next week.